Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Yes, friends at NOLA Drinks, we don't salute North Korean generals, and we think kids should be with their parents. Hey, we got a good show coming up for you here today. Our featured interview is with Jeff Beachbum Berry, cocktail historian, a restaurateur, author, and he focuses in particular on tiki culture. And Jeff, you know, comes from a very interesting background, did not start out as a bartender, did not start out as a distiller or anything along those lines. He did, again, started out as a writer and a historian, and has published numerous books and other things talking about tiki culture. And we visit with Jeff at his place, Latitude 29, the first establishment that he opened up, and it's here in New Orleans. He opened it with his terrific wife, Anine. A great place to go experience really actually excellent food, as well as explore tiki culture. So many classic drinks on the menu, new stuff inspired by the new wave of craft cocktails, and all kinds of interesting things like that there at Latitude 29, as I said, and we pay a visit there with Jeff, and we talk a lot about his books, his research, what is tiki culture, a so-called faux culture. It's a really, really interesting conversation, friends, about all things tiki, and so check that out. And also, if you're listening on the radio, you're going to get the bulk of the interview with Jeff as we talk with him about this stuff, but if you're listening on the podcast or you're interested in listening on the podcast, we do extended podcast-only content these days, and it's called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, and Jeff sticks with us there over at Latitude 29, and we get a little bit further into tiki culture. We talk about some interesting things, for example, like the aesthetic very much comes from, you know, the interiors of restaurants and bars and these things. That aesthetic comes really from the Pacific, from Polynesian and Melanesian culture, adapted from that, has a history connected to World War II and some of these things, and hence that's why that is the case. But really, the basis for most of the cocktails in the culture come from the Caribbean. So it's an interesting melding there, sort of all things tropical, I guess, if you will. But we get into some of that kind of stuff. We also talk about, for example, the effect that the so-called craft cocktail renaissance that's been going on for about the past 17, 18, 19 years or so, how that has affected tiki culture, which really pretty much died out in the 70s and 80s, and then has basically enjoyed a revitalization due in part to the craft cocktail renaissance, and also due in large part to the work that Jeff has done with all the research and publication and really keeping the culture alive in many ways. So really interesting conversation with Jeff. So check that out, and do check out the extended podcast only content on Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. Friends, wanted to mention an event coming up here this weekend, this Saturday, over in Mandeville, if you're listening on the radio. And as I mentioned before, as we now have the new format of the NOLA Drinks show, we're going to be moving more of our mentioning of local happenings, you know, events and music and things like that that we might be touching on the show. Not talking about it so much on the radio anymore, but sharing it on our Facebook page, which is easily found, facebook.com/NOLA Drinks, easy enough. But in this particular instance, it's a really, really good event. It's put on by a good friend of the show and somebody who contributes to the show, excuse me, Sal Mortilaro. Sal is one of our beer guys that comes on the show regularly to talk about all things suds with us. And this particular event is called Larry Hartzog's Twisted Brew Fest. And Larry is a friend of those guys. Larry passed away several years ago, big beer guy, home brewer, and also a big fan of animals. And so this particular event, as an ode to him, is benefiting the St. Tammany Humane Society, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It's this Saturday, June 23rd, as I said, from 4 to 8 p.m. There's a VIP entry at 3 p.m. There's a homebrew competition. There's opportunities to taste homebrews. Also, all kinds of commercially produced beers are going to be there. Live music, food. It's dog-friendly. It's indoors in the air conditioning. All kinds of cool stuff. So go do check it out. It's going to be, if you're into beer and you're into our fine furry friends, this is an event for you. Facebook.com/LarryBeerFest. All right. Hey, wanted to mention some stuff that came out in the news. It was first reported in The Advocate, a very interesting article penned principally by Ian McNulty. And it's a topic, friends, that we've talked about quite a bit on the show over the past year, year and a half or so, the state of the hospitality and restaurant business here in New Orleans, though I think a lot of what we talk about has implications that go well beyond this part of the world. We kind of focus for the most part on independent sit-down restaurants and bars. And we've talked about how it's a difficult landscape here, not just in New Orleans, but really in many, many places around the country and really beyond. But in New Orleans, it's pretty acute. And one of the things that maybe, I don't want to say is unique to here, but certainly something that happens here that doesn't happen everywhere, is how we sort of ebb and flow with the seasons. And we are coming up again on the summer months, which is typically a very tough period for restaurants, and in recent years has been an extremely tough period for restaurants with many, many closures that take place. And what the interesting thing that the Advocate article highlights are some numbers. We've talked a lot about this to some degree based on some data, a lot of anecdotal conversations we've had on various episodes talking about what particular business owners that run restaurants, what they see and what they understand. And then also, you know, looking at restaurant closures, which are well publicized. In fact, at Eater New Orleans, by my rough count here, just so far in 2018, according to them, we've already experienced 25 restaurant closures. But what the Advocate did is they did some research. They hung some numbers on some things, and I think it's a very instructive thing, and I think it's a very valuable thing that to reference to be able to talk about this with some more data. So one of the things they mentioned were the summer months, as I said, a very difficult period. Since from 2007 to 2017, 46% of the 542 restaurant closures took place in the summer. Currently, by their count, and they define it in a pretty particular way, they don't count, for example, delis in stores. They don't count gas stations, for example, that serve food. So how they define restaurants, kind of pretty clear, I think. They count 1,216 establishments in Orleans Parish alone. 605 of those are full service. 476 are counter service or fast food. And 135 are bars that serve food with their licensed kitchen. Now, that number was 984 pre-Katrina in August 2005. So we've had a net gain since then of 232, almost 24%. The largest increase is in the full-service sit-down restaurants, 152. Lots of competition in that space. Now let's further this a little bit. Right now, the estimated population of New Orleans is 393,000. That's about 81% of the pre-Katrina level. Prior to Katrina, we were looking at about 500 residents per restaurant, per establishment. And that's in 05. It is now 325 residents per. So less backs, if you will, in town, locals, which really help keep places open in the summer to, basically support these places. And it's a much smaller number now. We look at some of the best months versus the worst months. They cite a software provider called Womply, which is a Silicon Valley company that does credit card stuff for restaurants. And they cite December and March being the best months. That accounts, each one accounts for about 10% of the overall on average revenue for a restaurant. June and August are the worst at 7% each respectively. That accounts for a 30% difference in revenue from the best to the worst months. There's a huge amount of volatility. As I mentioned, about 25 or so restaurants have already closed, according to Eater, this year. Now, I did mention that there has been a net gain since pre-Katrina of 232 or 24%-ish, but the volatility is incredible. We're seeing restaurants close, open and close at a very fast rate. Now, sometimes these are well-established restaurants that have been around for a long time. In many cases, these are also restaurants, for example, one that just springs to mind that closed down very, very recently, Momo Ramen and Poke, closed after just 3 months. So one of the things that we talk about here, and we've touched on this a lot on the shows, is that, yes, there is a lot of competition. Some of those numbers I just gave you, and that is the case. So we have to look at that, the so-called saturation question, but also being able to survive the ebb and flow of the seasonal aspect of restaurants and hospitality in New Orleans. Yes, visitor numbers are up, and visitor numbers are up over the summer, but I think what we see is that we see more budget travelers, regional travelers that aren't going to come and spend as much money in some of these establishments during the summer months. Yes, we have the culinary month that comes up. Yes, Tales of the Cocktail is a big shot in the arm that comes up. But, you know, you have to be prepared for the summer months. A lot of restaurateurs think, hey, if I can just break even over the summer, then I'm looking good. But a lot of people come in, they open up a restaurant, they're not capitalized, they don't have a plan for surviving the summer, they don't even have much of a plan at all. Now, I think we're starting to see that slow down a little bit and people are being weeded out. I think we see more of the newer restaurants that are opening are people that are coming from established restaurant backgrounds, as opposed to somebody who is, say, a chef that moved from somewhere else and tries to open up their first place because they think New Orleans is a magical playground that will just work. And we've talked a lot about that on previous shows. As I mentioned. But again, getting back to this, the summer is really tough. And a lot of these things that the Advocate points out by hanging some data, they've done a good service and give us some more things, more talking points, and some hard facts that we can actually look at as we analyze more of these dynamics moving forward. Something we will continue to do on the show. Friends, wanted to mention too, really quick, since I mentioned Tales of the Cocktail, next week's show, we're going to sit down with Carolyn Rosen, who is the new executive director of Tales of the Cocktail, talking about that important event coming up in the third week of July, and also all the other stuff that they do around the year, really. So that'll be an interesting interesting show. Be sure to catch that. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. When we come back, we're going to be chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry. And get the podcast. Don't go anywhere after the show's over, the radio portion, and listen to another shot with NOLA Drinks, and we talk a little further with Jeff. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning into the NOLA Drink Show here today, friends. As always, as you know, if you're listening at the top of the show, and I hope you were, as I always say, we are here at Latitude 29, and we are visiting with Jeff Beachbum Berry, the proprietor, tiki author, historian of culture and cocktails and drinks and all kinds of stuff, and a man about the world. Jeff, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for coming.
Pleasure's mine. I'm a fan of the show.
Well, you're very kind to say that. I appreciate that very much. And we were kind of joking the other day when I ran into you at Two Jags about a week ago that actually happened. This is the first time you've been on the show with me, which is kind of ridiculous.
Almost. Long time listener, first time.
First time guest caller. Right. That's great. I figured, as I said to you, you're too big of a celebrity to be on a pissant show like this.
So, no. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, we are here at your spot, Jeff, at Latitude 29, and we'll get into Latitude in a little bit. It's a great spot here in New Orleans, and talk about your story about what prompted you to open the bar. But you are a historian of both cocktails, as I said, and culture, and tiki culture. And can we kind of tell people a little bit about what that is? What is tiki culture?
Sure. I mean, this is a drink show, obviously, so it's kind of cool that there was a huge Polynesian pop culture fad that went on for about 40 years in the mid 20th century. And unlike other pop culture fads or phenomenons, this one was engendered by drinks. Normally it works the other way around. Think about Sex and the City and the Cosmopolitan. Right. This one started with what we now call tiki drinks, which became a full blown pop culture thing that embraced architecture, fashion, music, you name it. Whole world went tiki crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely film. It just all went tiki crazy, but it all started because of the drinks as opposed to vice versa, which is kind of interesting. But to answer your question, what is tiki culture? It's what my friend Sven Kirsten, who wrote the first book about tiki culture, it was called The Book of Tiki, he calls it a modern primitive mashup. It happened in the mid-20th century when the U.S., after World War II, was embracing modernity and the space age and very future-minded, but at the same time, they were crazy for the South Seas and for this fantasy notion of the primitive island escape with carefree natives who didn't have to work or worry about mortgages or atom bombs or any of that kind of stuff. So that whole pop culture thing just became huge, and it was pretty much from, I think it peaked in the 1950s, but it started off after World War II in the 40s as a pop cultural thing. The drink thing started earlier, which we'll talk about. But the pop culture thing started with GIs coming back from the actual South Pacific in 45. And no matter how horrible a time they had in combat in the South Seas, all of them spent some time in Hawaii. It was a transshipment center for all of the U.S. forces. So they were there before they shipped out to fight. And if they were lucky enough to get back, they were there for a spell before they mustered back out home. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people, this is coming out of the Depression. You went from the Depression into the Army or the Navy or the Air Force, and most of these people could never in a million years have imagined themselves actually in the South Seas. And they actually got a taste of Hawaii, of paradise, whereas they couldn't have afforded to do that any other way. And they wanted to keep that vibe going. And you had what Sven also calls backyard Polynesia, the phenomenon of turning your very lifestyle into a Polynesian inflected thing. We're having luau's in the backyard with torches.
Planting palm trees, right?
Serving Mai Tais and everything. So the restaurant, that was a great boom for the restaurants, the Polynesian-themed restaurants. They sprang up all over the place. And it became a multi-million dollar business. You had people like Trader Vic opening up his national chain of very high-end white tablecloth fine dining restaurants.
Right.
That's another thing to remember is that this, as a culinary fad and as a drink fad, this was not the you know, thatched roof, beach bar, Jimmy Buffett, casual thing. These were chic. These were very high-end chic places for the most part, because the drinks were expensive to make and expensive to serve. And you had these places like Don the Beachcombers and the Trader Vic's chain and, you know, the Contiki's and the Sheraton. These were for upper middle class people or beyond.
Yeah.
And it was an expensive night out, you know, so it was considered fine dining back in the day. I mean, now we would think, well, it's tiki, it's tacky, who would do that? But back in the day, that was, you know, like the hip, cool thing to do.
And as you said, chic, experiential. Having spent some time growing up in the Bay Area and going to Trader Vic's as a child, it wasn't cheap. It was actually, it was an expensive, you know, it was something that I did with my parents maybe once a year.
Right. Right. I mean, I had a choice between doing my laundry or getting a Navy grog at Vic's.
Right,
I had a lot of dirty clothes for a long time. But to go a little deeper, the whole thing started the day after Prohibition in Hollywood when a guy named, called himself Don the Beachcomber, opened up the first real tiki bar. And it was sort of ground zero, the Big Bang. It became a huge hit. He was serving what he called his rum rhapsodies, what we today call tiki drinks.
He was kind of a mysterious guy, too, wasn't he? I mean, as far as...
He was a bit shady. He'd been a bootlegger. He'd been... He was involved with a mobster called Tony Cornero, and he'd had sort of a checkered background. He told people he was from Jamaica, or he told people he was from New Orleans. Actually, he was born in Mexia, Texas. His family was from New Orleans, though.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. Apparently his parents either owned or worked in a hotel here in the city. I've been trying to dig it up in the Central Library here, looking at old microfilm. Haven't found anything yet. His given name was Ernest Raymond Beaumont Gant, G-A-N-T-T. And there are a lot of Gants in the late 19th century registries in the library.
Okay, yeah.
Not a whole lot of Beaumont Gants. But you talk to some old-timers around the Orleans Parish, and they will talk about how there was a Gant who owned a ranch or some kind of spread out in Mandeville.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So I haven't had any confirmation of that, but it's something I got to look into one of these days. You know
we not to get too far off track here, we live in old Mandeville, and we live right by the museum. So I'll pass by there and ask.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's any old census rolls or anything like that, you know, that, who knows? Maybe we'll find out where he, because he did spend a lot of time with his grandfather, and that's supposedly where, you know, his grandfather had a boat and he went into the Caribbean, and that's where he first learned how to make drinks. Anyway, long story short, Don the Beachcomber, alias Mr. Beaumont Gant, opens up Don's Beach Cafe, and it becomes an immediate hit with the Hollywood crowd. Nobody had ever tasted drinks like this before. Just like really, really layered, visually captivating, delicious tropical drinks. And this is coming after 12 years of Prohibition, and nobody knew how to make any kind of a drink.
Right,
and here were these
right.
amazing rum rhapsodies, quote unquote. So within 3 years, there were 150 copycats as news spread, and you know, travel writers and radio broadcasters, and everybody was saying, go to Don the Beachcomber's, get a Zombie, which was his house drink. The Zombie was like the cosmopolitan of its day. Everybody, you know, radio comedians made jokes about it, columnists talked about it, just because it was such a strong... it was a lot of ballyhoo about how strong it was, but it was sort of a punch in the face to the anti-saloon league at the end of Prohibition, and as such, it really took off and really helped put Don on the map. So 150 copycats by 37, and by the time we got into World War II, there were even more, stretching from the Eastern Seaboard all the way from New York to Miami. Everybody was getting into this act, and the fad might have died out if not for World War II, where you had like a huge shot in the arm for it, you know, and it just kept zooming all the way up until the disco era.
Right, and through the 70s.
And then
we got about a minute before we got to take a break, Jeff. At that point, what caused it to die out? What caused it? Did it become so kitschy and then kind of dumbed down so much or something?
Well, it's a short answer, I think, is the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And where you had, you know, the World War II generation, the so-called Greatest Generation, this was their preferred mode of drinking. They drank Mai Tais and Navy grogs and Polynesian places. And of course, your kids are going to think that's uncool. You know, to the kids, to the new generation coming up, that was square. You know, they didn't want to have anything to do with that. So that was a generational shift. It was also the end of the cocktail era. I mean, people were smoking and snorting. They weren't drinking anymore. We were entering the cocktail dark ages in the 1980s.
You know? A lot of vodka, right?
Yeah. So it wasn't just tiki drink. It was every kind of cocktail just went out of favor. It was like,
Well, let's do this, Jeff. Let's take a little break real quick, and we're going to come back and talk with you more about some of your background, how you found yourself into the world of tiki. And of course, we're going to talk about Latitude 20. 29. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Come on back.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Oh, well, I'm sitting here la-la waiting for my ya-ya.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are here at Latitude 29 in the French Quarter. We are here chatting with Jeff Beach Bumberry, the proprietor, as well as being a historian and author of cocktail and culture as far as tiki goes. And Jeff, you're giving us sort of the background of tiki and something. Let's get into how did you find yourself in the world of tiki? What got you involved in? Because you started out more coming from the historical aspect of this as opposed to the restaurateur aspect of this, correct?
Well, I never intended to open a bar or write books. I mean, when I first started getting into this, I turned 21 back when snakes walked and dinosaurs ruled the earth in 1979, and I was old enough to legally drink. And one of the first places I went was this little tiny hole-in-the-wall bar in East Hollywood called the Tiki Tea, which, as it turns out, was run by a guy who was one of Don DeBeachcrumb's original bartenders in 1934. So the drinks were, as you can imagine, pretty good. It's still there today, by the way. But some of the first cocktails I had, legally, were these delicious tiki drinks. Some of these tall, cool, layered, teasingly elusive, like, what's in this drink? You couldn't figure it out when it was done right, you know? Mm-hmm. And
had you, Jeff, had had experience drinking super cloyingly sweet sort of faux tiki drinks before, and then this was a kind of a transformational thing?
Yeah, Brian, that's what everybody drank in the 70s was just like cruise ship drinks, yeah, you know, right, like neon blue or bright red, you know, every Mai Tais, every color of the rainbow. And they were just like, there was just like 7-Eleven slushies with just super sweet and completely imbalanced and terrible. And that was what the impression of what a tropical drink was for everybody who came of age at that time. Mm-hmm. And when I had these drinks, it was like a revelation. These were the only good drinks I had. Tiki drinks were the only good drinks I had in the 1980s. You know, because they were still being made with fresh squeezed juices and homemade syrups and all the stuff that people did back in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. They were craft cocktails decades before that term existed.
Right.
Whereas every place else you went, you know, you just got crap. You know, you just got sweet and sour mix poured into a glass.
Yeah, with soda and some booze, right?
Yeah. So that was really the only good drinks I had. And I went to all the places that still served them. But all those places were closing up. The fad was ending and all these places were shutting down. And eventually I thought, well, if I want to keep drinking these drinks, I have to learn how to make them myself. And that's what started me off on that, that path of trying to find out how to make them.
What were you doing before, Jeff? Before, what was your profession or did you study? What had you done before?
Well, the drink stuff was strictly a hobby.
Okay.
That was just what I did for fun. Mm-hmm. I liked the drinks. I liked finding out about the drinks. I liked collecting recipes, but that was total amateur, total hobbyist. I was in the movie business. I started off in film advertising, doing coming attractions and writing copy for posters and all that. And eventually got into the Writers Guild and started doing screenplay rewrites and eventually got into the Directors Guild and directed one TV movie, which was the beginning and end of my directing career.
Can we find that on Netflix?
fortunately, no. But I still, you know, but... if you really are into masochism, I can give you a DVD.
Get right on, yeah, for sure. So you obviously had a background in writing then. And the reason why I'm asking this question, because, you know, to go from collecting recipes and being a hobbyist of tiki cocktails and culture in this case to actually taking the step to write,
yeah,
that's a big step.
I'd been writing forever. I mean, I at UCLA, I was a film school guy, but I also wrote the reviews for the entertainment section of the UCLA paper,
okay,
which had a circulation of 30,000. I mean, it was like, you know, like a real paper.
Yeah.
And I eventually became the entertainment editor of that. And then my first gigs out of school were freelance reviews for the LA Times Book Review. And I wrote for the Herald Examiner. That's when there were two newspapers in LA.
Okay, yeah.
And some magazine work, you know, quickly realized that freelance journalism, even back then, was not going to be a good way to pay the rent, you know, so I sort of fell into the advertising thing. But no, I had always written, and I always, and all that time doing the screenplay work really gave me a sense of narrative, and all the journalism stuff told me how to interview people. And you know, cause I'd done a lot of feature stories about people and, mm-hmm. and done a lot of interviewing, and I had that background. So when it came time to actually start writing about the people who made these drinks, and, or to talk to their families if they were deceased, I could do that, you know, and I could shape a story. Mm-hmm. And I could also research. I mean, I knew how to go into the, back then they still had card indexes, you know, so
sure.
That's how I found all the old magazines and books, uh-huh. and cocktail books and all that stuff. And, I was also a thrift store and swap meet fiend and found a lot of good ephemera back then, you know, like old tiki restaurant menus and magazine articles and stuff like that through that source. So,
And I think it's interesting because with the background you're talking about knowing how to tell a story, I think from my perspective, when we talk about tiki culture, it's a story, right?
It is.
There's a lot of storytelling involved.
It is. It's got a narrative arc. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And now it has a rebirth. It's got a coda. It's got a whole fourth act coming now, you know, in the middle of this cocktail renaissance. I mean, I never thought I'd see the day when there are craft cocktail tiki bars opening up all over the world at a dizzying pace. I can't keep track of all the openings.
Sure.
You know, and it's amazing. It's like it's a really, really cool time to be into tropical drinks.
Yeah, there you go. Now, you then took the plunge and started. You decided, I need to get this together and start taking this seriously, if you will, to catalog the stuff, tell a story, yeah, write and publish books. And that, when did you start? Did you take that step?
I started, even though it was pre-internet, I finally started to meet other people who were as into this geeky, obscure stuff as I was. And one of my friends called himself Otto von Stroheim, after the old silent film director. He was a surfer and this, like, you know, alternative culture hipster dude. And he would have luau's at his place in Venice Beach. And he knew I was into the drink, so I would make the punches while bands would play and people would hang out. And it was more of a tiki pop culture thing. Nobody was really that into the drinks. Nobody knew how to make the drinks, you know.
Right.
So I'd make a punch and people would come up and say, hey, what's in that? That's not bad. And eventually enough people did that so that Otto helped me put together a little Xerox booklet. He was a graphic designer, so he helped me put it together. And I went to Kinko's and printed it and stapled it there in Kinko's. And when people asked me for the recipes, I said, here's everything I know. And I just gave it out. And one of those found its way up to a comic book publisher in San Jose, Slave Labor Graphics. Their big titles were Johnny the Homicidal Maniac,
okay,
and Milk and Cheese. And the owner, Dan Vado, was a tiki freak. And he said, hey, do you want to put out a book? And I said, all right. You know, there's like no money in it or anything. It was, again, hobby, you know. So it was like this little spiral-bound thing, that, which was Beach Bunbury's Grog Log. And it was only available in comic book stores because that's all he knew how to distribute. He'd never done a real book before. So consequently, there's a lot of people in the comics world who were familiar with these drinks way before everybody else was, you know. And that's what started it off. You know, I just did three or four of those with him. And at that time, I was just obsessed with recipes. I was very single-minded. All I wanted was the recipes. I wanted to know how to make these drinks. I wanted to track down these recipes and crack them, because sometimes they were in like bartender shorthand or a code. And
sure. Okay.
And it was sort of detective work, you know. But I got down that rabbit hole, and I was kind of obsessed. And it took me four books to realize that all these old-timers I was interviewing to try and get recipes out of them, all these old Filipino bartenders who had worked back in the day, they were telling me amazing stories about their own lives and about the world they lived in and about the people they hung out with, like serving drinks to Howard Hughes and mm-hmm. and being secret sources for gossip columnists and being teenage jungle fighters in World War II. Mm-hmm. And gradually it penetrated my thick skull that, you know, this may be more interesting than the recipe. So so by 2007, I think it was my fourth book, where Sip and Safari, where I finally hit on that notion of let's tell the stories, and the recipes just became sidebars. And that's sort of like what I've been doing since, you know, with Potions of the Caribbean and the other things. Just
gotcha.
Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff. And let's do this, Jeff. Let's take a little bit of a break here because I want to get back in. We'll come back. Let's talk about the books because you just celebrated the anniversary, 10th anniversary of Sip and Safari. And we're going to talk about Latitude 29. So you not only did you take the plunge to become an author and do this, you now have decided to take the plunge a few years back and open up a bar and restaurant here in New Orleans, which is a great spot, Latitude 29. Friends, that's where we're taping right now. We're chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry here at Latitude 29. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Friends, come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. We are here at Latitude 29 chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry. And Jeff, before we went out to the break, we touched on your background a little bit and how you got into coming in from an author and historian side of things. And we started to get into the books that you've written, and you've got some great books out there. And one of them, Sip and Safari, you just celebrated your 10th anniversary with the publication of the book.
Yeah, we've come out with a 10th anniversary edition. It kind of had to be done. I mean, the book came out in 2007, and that's when I broke the previously unpublished Lost Don the Beachcomber recipes. These were very valuable trade secrets, these recipes, and since everybody was ripping Don off, he went to great pains to make sure that nobody could take his drinks elsewhere, particularly bartenders who worked for him, because the main reason the drink spread was that people would poach his bartenders, pay him more money, and get his recipes. Mm-hmm. So he put his recipes in code. And of course, he never published them. And it was only like years after I started trying to find out what was in his drinks that some of the descendants of some of these bartenders said, "Hey, my dad's got a shoebox of old memorabilia, and there's a recipe book. Do you want it?" It's like, finally, you know, after looking for 10 years, I got some of these original Don the Beachcomber recipes, and they were in code. And they had things like syrup number 4 or spices number 2, and there was no way to figure out what was in that unless you could meet somebody who knew. And I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, L.A., around that time when you can still run into bartenders who had worked in those places. And gradually, it took years, but I figured out one by one what some of these code words were, and published the recipes for the first time in Sip and Safari. And I didn't think it was any big deal because nobody was really into tiki drinks. The cocktail renaissance was going on, but everybody was focused on pre-prohibition Jerry Thomas classics.
Sure.
And they were talking about Martinez's and Corpse Survivors and Old Fashions, and nobody cared about tiki drinks because they had that preconception that we talked about earlier of them being syrupy, slushy cruise ship drinks. So I thought, I'm just doing this for myself and for a few tiki geeks. And Dan Vado, the publisher, he didn't expect a huge return on the book. So it was all labor of love. And then just a couple of years later, craft cocktail tiki bars start appearing, and they're using all the recipes. And and they're making, hundreds of thousands of dollars based on Sip and Safari. And I thought, this is awesome. This is great. And this tiki bar renaissance happened. And in the 10 years since it came out, it's become this global phenomenon. Tiki bars are winning James Beard Awards, Drinks International's 50 Best Bars Awards, they're winning Tales of the Cocktail Awards, our cocktail festival right here in town. Mm-hmm. And it was like, wow, this is amazing. I gotta do a new edition that talks about this. We just came out this year with a new edition of Sip and Safari, which has a 40-page afterward, charting the tiki revival that happened after Sipping came out. And I interviewed some of the best practitioners around the world and said, did the book influence you at all? And if so, how? And I got contemporary recipes from them and put that in the book. And I also did a 40-page preface talking about how the book came to be. And there were also, there's 14 additional previously unpublished vintage tiki recipes from the 30s and 40s that back in 2007, I either did not know how to decode or I wasn't sure how to make. So now I put those in the book, or I didn't have them yet. I mean, other recipes surfaced after the book came out. So So I put all that stuff in the book, and just now it's a hardcover, real book with a spine
and the whole thing and the full backstory and preface and everything else. Well, Jeff, let's talk about this. We'll come back at the end of this segment. We'll come back because I want to tell people where they can get the books. But then you took another step and you decided to open your own place. And here we sit at Latitude 29 in New Orleans.
Well, yep. Let me correct you just a little bit when you said that I took another step.
Oh, okay. should we give Aneen credit for some of this?
Aneen, Mrs. Bum, Aneen K, kind of dragged me kicking and screaming into opening a place. I thought it was too much work, even with Aneen doing most of it.
It's my fault for saying that. I apologize.
Just simple clarification. But Aneen had a service industry background that was quite impressive. I mean, ever since she was like a no-wave punk rocker in the Lower East Side in New York in the 70s, she's been a bouncer, a cook, a host, a bartender, a manager. She's done everything. And that, all that was in her past, but by the time I met her in the 90s, she had moved on. She was a music writer and music journalist, and that was all just ancient history. But she saw the way the winds were blowing and that this thing was becoming huge, this Tiki Revival, and the books were making no money. And as you know, if you've ever written a cocktail book, it doesn't happen. So it's a niche of a niche of a niche. You know, you're not going to be able to buy a place in the Hamptons based on cocktail recipe books. So she said, well, why don't you stop serving drinks? Why don't you stop writing about drinks and start serving them like everybody else is doing? And I was resistant, but she talked me into it, and I'm really glad she did because I'm having so much fun. I mean, it's a great experience. Granted, I'm just the guy in the hat, you know, greeting people. I mean, she's doing all the work with our general manager and head bartender, Brad Smith, and our great crew. I mean, when you've got the right crew, that's when you come into the restaurant and you realize you're the most vestigial person on the staff. Like if all the cylinders are firing and everybody's really doing their job, there's no reason for you to be there. You know, it's like,
just do the Queen's wave, right?
Just, you know, like Alan Hale's lobster barrel, just sit there and, you know, I'm really enjoying it. It's great. And New Orleans, of course, was the only place we ever even remotely considered opening up. It was where
Aneen has some roots here, correct? Or some ties here at least, right?
Well, we both did at the same time. Neither of us had been to the city until 2005.
Okay.
August 2005, when we were invited by Tales of the Cocktail to come down to do a spirited dinner at Tujac's. And we were looking for a place to move to from Los Angeles, and nothing was really speaking to us. And we got off the airport shuttle in the quarter, and it's like, where the hell has this place been all our lives? You know, it's like Barcelona or some other old European city, and there are Juilliard-trained musicians playing on the street, and everyone we met was really cool and friendly and nice. And it was like, okay, this is it. You know, we're moving here. And that was a week before Katrina. So we had to, you know, dial it back a little bit. But we kept coming back every year to Tales, and gradually more than once a year to do other events. And our acquaintances in the service industry widened, and we met more bartenders and owners, and everybody just was really great. And this city was where the love was. And they didn't have a craft cocktail tiki bar.
Right.
I mean, now you've got Tolteca here, which opened up just before we did, but when we were planning, they weren't open yet. And everybody wants to help you. It's like an unfortunate metaphor, a rising tide lifts all boats.
Sure.
but that's what this city's like, and it's the anti-LA. I mean, in Los Angeles, it's not enough for you to succeed. Your best friend has to fail. You know, that's kind of the ethos.
Right.
And here, that you don't get any of that neurotic, negative stuff. You know, it's just like...
You know, it's something we talk about on the show a lot, Jeff, is and I don't want to go too far down this road, but the understanding that, you know, a vibrant restaurant scene, a vibrant bar scene is good for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And playing like good neighbors is it's always been part of the culture, but it's part of the business culture here, especially on the hospitality side. It is what makes New Orleans what it is.
We felt so, it was so refreshing to run into that, you know, restores your faith in humanity. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Jeff, we got about a minute and a half before we're going to end the radio portion. We want to set this up because we're going to stick around and chat with our podcast only stuff on another Shot with Nola Drinks and get into the weeds a little bit more, but tell people where can we find the books and where can we find Latitude 29?
Yeah, you can get them, just go on cocktailkingdom.com, or you can go on my website, beachbunberry.com, and that will direct you It'll have some background on the books, and there are links to Cocktail Kingdom. It'll be available on Amazon in a few weeks, but they're sort of taking their time getting it on Amazon.
Okay.
So if you don't want to wait for Amazon, CocktailKingdom.com, or you can come into Latitude. We stock it here. There's no guarantee that we won't have run out, but we get regular shipments of the books, so we have copies here at Latitude.
And you'll sign them if you're here, right?
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
And Latitude 29, what's the address and website and all that good stuff?
That is in the Bienville House Hotel between Decatur and Peters in the Quarter. It's 320 Decatur, I believe.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Okay, there you
go.
You can find it. Bienville House Hotel, go that way.
Yeah.
And you guys are open from 3? You open at 3?
Yeah, 3 to 11. And then on Friday and Saturday, we open up in the afternoon for lunch, open from 1 o'clock on to midnight. And happy hour every day, 7 days a week from 3 to 6, food specials and drink specials by our very talented and lovely bar staff.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that during another shot, because I want to get into the food here is excellent, and the quality of service and the drinks and everything. Happy hour is great.
Oh,
everything's
you.
Really good here. So friends, what we're going to do here, if you're listening on the radio, we're going to sign off the show here on the NOLA Drink Show, but I encourage you to stick around. If you're listening on the podcast, it's going to happen for you anyway, whether you want to or not, if you keep listening, I suppose, or if you're listening on the radio, then go check out the podcast. We're going to do a round called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, or we're going to chat a little further with Jeff. So everybody, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until then, cheers, y'all. Thanks for sticking around for another shot with NOLA Drinks. Special shout out to our good friends, the band Bon Bon Vivant, the theme song to Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. Yep, Saints and Sinners from their great album Paint and Pageantry. Check it out. We're about to continue our conversation with Jeff Beachbum Berry. We're going to talk a little bit more about Latitude 29, a little bit more about tiki culture, a little bit more about tiki cocktails. And then stick around for when that's over for our parting shot, talking about tariffs and whiskey. Here we go. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for hanging out and listening to us here on Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. Yep, it's the home of the podcast-only content that we do here on the show, where, so I like to say, we get a little further into the weeds, the 10,000-foot level, whatever you want to talk about. And we are sitting here at Latitude 29 with Jeff Beachbum Berry, who is the proprietor here. And Jeff, before we jump into some deeper tiki topics, let's talk a little bit further, just really quickly, because I want to come back to Latitude 29. Great food here and great service. I was talking about that at the end of the previous segment, and I think one of the things that maybe some of the places, as we got further into the 70s and 80s with some of the tiki places, the emphasis wasn't the food necessarily, but you guys do fantastic stuff here.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I mean, Aneen works long and hard with our chef, Marcel, to deliver that kind of stuff, and there are several reasons for that. One is that we do have to fight that preconception that when you go to a tiki place, you're just going to get crappy food like teriyaki chicken or what have you.
Chewy teriyaki chicken.
Yeah, yeah. So we wanted to fight that that preconception and give people a full experience that the food has to be commensurate with the drinks. I mean, one can't let the other down. The other is because of where we are. I mean, we are in the food town in North America. I mean, this town lives, eats, sleeps, breathes food, mm-hmm. and you got to represent. I mean, in this, if we opened up in Atlanta or Chicago or you know, anywhere else, we may not have had to pay as much attention to the food as we do. But we're in New Orleans, and that, you know, you can't get away with that here.
Yeah, you'll be exposed, like, right?
Yeah, I mean, you go into a convenience store to get a sandwich, and it's going to blow your mind. You know, so you've got to think gourmet. You got to think flavor. You got to try and hold your own against all the amazing restaurants and just like casual takeout places that exist all around you. You know, mm-hmm. so that was a main factor as well.
And you guys executed the ribs here. One of my very favorite things
on
the planet. Absolutely,
thank you.
And one of the things I think is also really interesting with the drinks is, of course, we've touched on tiki culture and all this work that you've put in, writing books and other research that you've done to collect these recipes. But you also do a really neat thing that I really appreciate here, where you have a staff of talented bartenders that work here. I'm going to give a shout out to Steve Yamada, my good buddy over there that's there right now. Everybody gets a chance to contribute and kind of come up with new tiki inspired cocktails, especially on the happy hour menu.
Yeah. We've got some very, very talented people on this crew, and it would be a shame just to have them be a pair of hands to make my menu, you know, to make my drinks, which is, that's the core menu, mm-hmm. but happy hour provides a way for each of them to express themselves creatively and to come up with their own take on these drinks. And that's all filtered through our head bartender, Brad Smith, mm-hmm. who has one of the most perfect palates of anyone I've ever met, traveling all over the world, going to bars. I mean, he's a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. So he's in charge of, like, they bring the drinks to him, he tests them, they workshop them, and eventually present them on the happy hour menu. Like, every bartender has a drink on the menu, mm-hmm. every time we change the menu. We're trying to work it up to once a month. It's a little more haphazard than that but we're trying to do a turnover once a month with a new drink. And the first few times I tasted some of the drinks that some of our bartenders did, it actually frightened me. It's like, we've created monsters, because these drinks are the kind of drinks that you only taste when somebody's been doing this for 25, 30 years and, mm-hmm. and really knows their shit. And like some of our, like, you know, Sam, who's never tended a bar in his life, started as a bar back here. I mean, his first couple of drinks were like, where the hell did you get this from? These are genius. I mean, they're 21st century modern takes using folding modern ingredients into the old school way of doing things and just surprising you. I mean, I'm continually surprised by the drinks. My own staff surprises me with these things, and it's just such a good feeling.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. It's awesome. And I think I know, that having our good friend, one of your bartenders, Kimberly Patton Bragg, was on the show with me a couple weeks ago. Very talented bartender. And Kim's been you know, behind the stick for a while. And I know in previous conversation with Kim that she was very enthusiastic to be here because, you know, Kim has a strong background in whiskey, strong background in tequila. But the first time she's ever really tackled tiki.
Yeah.
And so you've got talented people, and then unbridling them to explore and utilize their talents, I think, is great.
Yeah, well, Kim, everybody brings something else to the table. They all bring their skill sets. They all bring their own individual creative process to it. And, you know, Kim works amazingly with gin and whiskey, and she's done all kinds of very interesting tinctures and syrups in her other places, you know, and seeing her bring that knowledge to bear on this style of drink making has been really fun. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I mean, she's doing stuff with, you know, plum wine and all kinds of other things that I never would have thought of. You know, it's like,
it's fantastic. And it's great that you do that. And you have a very talented staff here. So I wanted to make sure that we touched on that. Because it's a great experience when you come here. You can get the classic tiki recipes here, the Navy Grog and the Missionary's Downfall and all these great drinks that have great stories. And then there's the revisioning, if you will, of creating new modern classics, I'll say, because you have the people to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, they're nice people. That's the other thing. It's like, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've gone into a craft cocktail bar and you get attitude from the mixologist, quote unquote. But everybody here is that they serve you the drink with a smile. You know, that's
absolutely. One of my favorite lines in town here, Jeff. And again, not to get too far off on a tangent, a bartender Darren Elista, who used to run the beverage program at Sylvain. We were having a conversation some number of years ago about the term mixology.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, it kind of walked into the bar, and I said jokingly, how, you know, how does it feel to be a noted mixologist? And his response was, fuck you, I'm a bartender. And in New Orleans, that meant something.
Right. Well, I'm of two minds about the term, though. I do like the term.
Sure.
I think it's funny. And I think, and that's what the, it was intended to be funny. I mean, it's from the 19th century. You know, it's like you would just when you would call bartenders professor or mixologist or gambrinus, and there was that sort of like puffed up, inflated self parody. I always thought the term was great. I mean, I ran across it reading old cocktail books in the 90s, and I always liked it. But it has connotations now that are unavoidable, you know, like with our Renaissance. And I can see why people would just want to cast that mantle off. It's like, no, damn it, I'm a 10 I'm bar.
A bartender, you know? Especially here in New Orleans, where bartender's been an honored trade forever, so yeah, I don't necessarily need to take that mantle on.
It's always been a respected profession. You don't have to cloak yourself in anything else. It's just accepted, you know, yeah.
Right, chef might go a little far.
That one I have a problem with.
Yeah, it goes a little far, yeah. Well, Jeff, let's talk about this, because I think and when we talk about tiki culture, and you and I just touched on this on the break before we came into the podcast stuff here, that a lot of the aesthetic of tiki culture draws heavily from Polynesian and Melanesian culture, really. But like as you say in Potions of the Caribbean, one of your excellent books, really the basis for a lot of the cocktails we're talking about come from the Caribbean.
Yeah, if you want to get right down to the basics, if you want to describe the whole phenomenon, the whole mid-century tiki bar phenomenon was Caribbean drinks being served in Polynesian decor. And the reason for that is there were no Polynesian cocktails to appropriate or to use. I mean, the French Polynesians drank French table wine, you know, imported from the colonial masters. And in Melanesia, they drank kava, you know, which we were talking about before. And in Hawaii, they drank okuliha, which is basically a moonshine from Hawaii. No, there were no real Polynesian or Melanesian cocktails. Just one that Sven Kirsten figured out. There was a drink called the Dr. Funk, and we always wondered what the hell is that about? Where'd that name come from? And Sven did a little digging, and he found out there was an actual Dr. Bernard Funk in Samoa, and he was Robert Louis Stevenson's personal physician. Oh. He was a German doctor, and he invented a drink which was called the Dr. Funk, which was basically absinthe, lime, and lemon juice. And Don Beach took that and monkeyed with it a little bit and then put it on his menu. But aside from that, I think every single classic, quote unquote, tiki drink has its roots in the Caribbean. In the Caribbean, of course, you've got that holy trinity of Caribbean mixology, which is rum, lime, and sugar, which applies to just about every classic drink from the islands. I mean, the Planter's Punch is Jamaican. Jamaican Planter's Punch is Jamaican rum, lime, and sugar. The Cuban daiquiri is Cuban rum, lime, and sugar. The tea punch in Martinique is Martinique agricole rum, lime, and sugar. and all the way down the line, you know. And what Don did was he took those three very simple components, and he multiplied each one of them. So you can't accuse Don or Vic or other tiki bartenders of appropriating Caribbean drinks, because they didn't. They used that as their template, and then they embroidered their own creative take on it.
Broaden the palette of it.
It would be like accusing a chef of appropriating a steak. You know, it's just like that very basic thing of rum, lime, and sugar, that punch construct, which had been around for hundreds of years.
Right.
What Don did was he took every element of that and he dimensionalized it. For the lime juice, you know, the sour element, it's like, well, why just lime? What if we mix lime and grapefruit? What if we mix multiple citruses together to create a more layered sour element? Same thing with the sugar. Like, why just sugar? Why not use honey or falernum, you know, which is a Barbados clove, ginger, lime liqueur? Mm-hmm. Why not use a passion fruit syrup and mix that with honey? What happens when you do that? What happens if you mix honey and falernum? What happens if you mix grenadine and maple syrup? So he was experimenting with multiple sweet elements. What happens if you infuse that sugar with cinnamon and vanilla and allspice, and just creating a much more layered sweet element? The most ingenious thing he did, and as far as I know, he's the first person ever to do it, was he did the same thing with the base spirit element. Why just Jamaican rum in a tall punch? What happens if you mix this heavy, dense, molassesy, sweet Jamaican rum with a light, floral, dry Cuban rum? The two rums inform each other. They create something more interesting than any one bottle could give you. What if you take those two rums and on top of those you put a smoky, charred wood-tasting Demerara rum from Guyana and add another dimension to it? So he was creating a base flavor with the rum that no one bottle could give you, and that was ingenious. And even the ice. You know, the weak element, instead of shaking with ice or swizzling with ice, he used in the 1930s what was the cutting edge culinary technology of its day. Today it would be a rotovap or a liquid nitrogen, but back then it was the electric blender. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of an electronic swizzle stick. So he took all of these multiple sweets, multiple sours, and multiple rums, put them in a blender with a very carefully measured amount of crushed ice, just as carefully jiggered as every other element. And what that did was, and just flash blended it for 3 to 5 seconds. That does not give you a slushy drink, but what happens is just the right amount of that ice gets diluted that you want diluted to instantly dilute, chill, and aerate the drink in a way that shaking or swizzling manually couldn't do. Mm-hmm. So even that, you know, he turbocharged that. So this was his take on the Caribbean basics, and created these Baroque fantasias based on this very simple formula and gave them Polynesian names because he had a Polynesian themed bar.
And that's where the aesthetic, bringing the aesthetic together with that. Well,
right.
And Jeff, you touched on this just in passing, as you said, something weak, and there's kind of an interesting ratio, yeah, right, that everybody draws from. Can you tell people about that?
Oh, something strong, the 200-year-old piece of Jamaican doggerel that was the original Planter's Punch recipe is one of sour, two of sweet, three of strong, four of weak. Sour, of course, being the lime, sweet being sugar, strong being the rum, and weak being water, and later ice when they started getting ice. And then, of course, you add another line to that and a pinch of spice to make it nice, which could be like Angostura bitters, a little nutmeg or whatever.
Sure.
And that formula, more or less, has been the basis of all of Don's drinks. It's the basis of the Zombie. It's the basis of the Navy Grog. It's the basis of all his famous drinks. But he monkeyed with it. I mean, I personally think one of sour, two of sweet, three of strong, four of weak is not a very good drink. It's too sweet. It's too weak. It's not very good. What Don did was he used the Fred Myers ratio. Fred Myers of Myers Rum, back in the late 19th, early 20th century, changed the poem. It didn't rhyme anymore, but it made a better drink. It was two of sour, one of sweet, three of weak, four of strong.
This is why I can't remember it, because yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that makes if you try that, it makes a much better drink. Uh-huh. And that's really what Don did, is he monkeyed around with those proportions, but he still hewed to the basic Caribbean 200-year-old punch recipe.
Right. Yeah. Now, let me ask you this too, because in having spent some time both living and working fairly extensively in the Caribbean and the Latin American portion of Caribbean, as well as the Eastern Caribbean, you see a lot of local distillates. Often it's rum or, you know, sugar cane, fermented sugar cane juice, whatever we're talking about here, and then infused with fresh fruits or infused with allspice. I think, of course, we talk about like cacoa and chili being used in Mexico, for example, mm-hmm. in some of these things. So I'm guessing that some of that was out there when Don was coming around and doing these things in his travels, that he was seeing some of these flavors, not necessarily just in and of themselves, but perhaps being integrated in drinks and markets and what locals were drinking, or is that maybe after?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Brian. We have to extrapolate a lot, but we do know from fragments of an autobiography that he wrote but never published, which were eventually strung together and put out by a mutual publishing in Hawaii. We do know that he spent a lot of time in Jamaica and Haiti, and by extension, probably in Cuba, you know, mm-hmm. with his grandpappy from Mandeville, and on their yacht. Mm-hmm. His grandfather was a rum runner during Prohibition, so he spent a lot of time buying rum and smuggling it into Port of New Orleans and selling it. And Don went along on the voyages as a teenager. So there are all, as you mentioned, there are all kinds of infusions done down there. I mean, when I was in Martinique, I saw a million of them just for sale in all these bottles in the open market.
Yeah.
You know, one of them was interesting, was Bois Band, which is supposed to be like an aphrodisiac bark that they infuse rum with. And the interesting thing for me was when I finally cracked, there's a drink called the Nui Nui, which you can get here at Latitude. Mm-hmm. When I finally cracked that recipe, it was a frustrating recipe. It was like lime, orange, number two, number four, rum, and number eight. And number eight turned out to be Angostura bitters, of all things.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But number two was a mixture of vanilla and allspice, and number four was cinnamon syrup. So what happens if you take allspice, vanilla, and cinnamon and you infuse them with rum? You get spiced rum.
Yeah.
You get what, that's Captain Morgan. That's basically every spiced rum out there is vanilla, cinnamon, and And also, so it's no, and that they do that in the Caribbean. They infuse rum, as you said, you saw it yourself with spices. So it's possible that Don tasted some form of homemade, you know, backyard spiced rum back then, and deconstructed it and put those things into a syrup form and added them into that drink.
Brought it back in. Well, yeah. There's a couple more things I want to ask you, Jeff, but since we kind of went there, and now we were talking during the break a little bit about some of the secrecy, for example, that shrouded Don's recipes. And, you know, you talked about how the way to learn the recipes was poach a bartender because he didn't, you know, people were knocking off his business model. And I get that from the sense of the business sense. But I've always been kind of fascinated because we talk about tiki culture, and part of, I think, the veil of tiki culture, if you will, is that, you know, the appeal is shrouded in mystery to a degree. And I just kind of find that story in a certain sense. It's almost like a self-fulfilling legacy, perhaps, in that, you know, keeping these recipes secret just kind of plays into that mystery and that aesthetic.
It does. Of course, the whole South Seas fantasy of the mysteries of the Orient and the forbidden pleasures of the, you know, the islands and all that. When you look at menus from the 1950s and 60s in tiki restaurants, they play on that. They definitely play it up. It's definitely ballyhoo or our secret recipe. Don't ask, we won't tell you what's in it. You know, it's like, right. They actually started to use that in marketing, you know, and play it up as part of the experience. Like, we're making these secret potions for you. And I ran into that in the 80s and 90s all the time. I'd ask Ray Boone, the guy who was running Tiki Tea, is like, Ray, this drink is great. What's in it? And the answer would always be rum and fruit juice. You know? It was like, okay, what about this drink? Rum and fruit juice. All right, I get the idea. You know, so he wasn't going to part with any of this stuff because that was valuable knowledge.
Sure.
It was valuable intel to have these secret recipes. I mean, these little black books they carry around, the little phone books that fit in your shirt pocket with the recipes in them. That was like that was the grimoire. You know, that's the passage into lifetime employment. You know, so. But basically why Don encoded his recipes to begin with was, yeah, people were stealing his bartenders, or they were reverse engineering the drinks sitting at the bar. And what he did was, all right, here's how I'm going to stop this. If he hires you, Brian, you're a new hire at Don's. He doesn't know you. You're not a trusted old timer. And eventually you work up to the point where you're going to make the drinks and you get these recipes. Here's the recipes you're going to get, like the Nui Nui, number two, number four, or a drink will say Syrup Parisienne or Munroloff or all these things. And that's what the label on the bottle was. The label on the bottle on the back bar said number two, number four, Munroloff, Syrup Parisienne, Marquesa was another one. Mm-hmm. And that's what you poured. So if somebody hired you, like if I hire you away, I want you to make the Beachcomber drinks at Latitude 29. You get behind the bar and you go, where's your number two? Where's your number four? Where's your Marquesa? I can't do it. And it worked. It worked really, really well. And it kind of stopped the theft of his recipe so that people just had to guess at them. But it also ensured that Don would not have much of a legacy after he died, because unlike Trader Vic, who published his recipes before he died and ensured his legacy, Don never did. He kept them very close to his chest until he passed away in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Of course, during his lifetime, that was a useful thing for him to do, but, you know, he was forgotten because of that. Right. Whereas Trader Vic was always in people's minds because he had those books out there. Mm-hmm. Like craft cocktail bartenders could find a copy of Trader Vic's 1972 book and know how to make his most famous drinks, the Mai Tai, the Fog Cutter, the Scorpion. But when it came to Don's drinks, all they had were knockoffs and bogus recipes that had been printed over the years that weren't the real thing.
As you said, you worked very hard too. How much more do you have? I mean, are there a lot that are out there that you haven't cracked?
Yeah, there are quite a few out there that I haven't cracked yet. There are drinks on his Hawaii. When he moved to Hawaii after the war and opened up his Beachcombers in Waikiki, he came up with all kinds of new drinks for which I do not have the recipes. There's like a cannibal grog, and there's like a cherry blossom punch, and there's like all these other things I don't know how to make, you know. So I hope there's still some guy out there, some 90-year-old dude who could tell me.
Right, still digging.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, Jeff. The last question I really have for you in general is, we were talking a little bit about this too, that, you know, we go through this period of, and I think we understand, we've talked about this on the show before, that we go back to like the Jerry Thomas days or some of these days where, you know, all everything that was available to you. You know, you had a base beer and everything that you were making, syrups, whatever. We're talking about fresh ingredients because we did not have processed foods at that time, right, and other things. So believe it or not, everything was fresh. And then we kind of move into this time in the 30s, 40s that you're talking about with the advent of tiki culture. And then we get past that a little bit and we kind of lose that. Now, as we kind of dumb things down, we got a time of vodka, really a time of tequila and some of these things, and a very simple, cloyingly sweet ship drinks, as you said. But now, as of maybe 15, 20 years ago, as we move back into the so-called craft cocktail renaissance, we now have a boom again of both old products that have become available again to us, as well as people coming up with new products. And I'm speculating that that's a pretty transformational process in the world of tiki as well.
It's a very exciting time to be involved with all of these old recipes, because back when I first started to decode and make them in the 90s at home, over the kitchen sink, I mean, you could not get falernum. You could not get allspice liqueur. You could not get half the rums that are available now, you know, these overproof rums. It was all... You had to make it yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had to make your own allspice liqueur. Mm-hmm. You had to make your own falernum, your own, orgeat was available, but all these passion fruit syrup, in and out, all these things that you had to spend most of your day making syrups and making liqueurs in order to make a drink.
Putting them in the cupboard for a week and a half.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And now it's all out there and it's fantastic, you know, and people are coming up with new things all the time. I mean, the rums that are coming out now are very exciting. A lot of domestic rums. So right here in Louisiana, you've got some very nice overproof agricoles being made by Caneland and Baton Rouge. And then you've got right here on Broad Street,
7-3 or...
Relaison.
Oh, Relaison. Yes, yeah. Right. Okay.
Fantastic work. And all these, you've got so many more things in your toolbox now, you know, that just didn't exist.
Some of these old liqueurs are like dry curacao, Pierre Franz.
I remember when Ted Haig was a buddy of mine in L.A., you know, we would drive all over L.A. and San Bernardino County going, looking for the crappiest, dustiest liquor stores we could find to look for dead stock, you know, stuff that might still be around that we could use in some of the recipes that we were really curious about but could not make. Mm-hmm. And in Ted's case, it was creme de violette was something that he was looking for and could never find. And he had all these old recipes he wanted to make. And now it's being made, you know. And it's all amazing. And all this stuff's amazing. You know, it's all out there.
Yeah. It's changed a lot, right?
Oh,
this
yeah.
This pushes it forward into another generation or another era.
Yeah, I couldn't have predicted any of this. I mean, it's just it's great.
That's excellent. Well, hey, Jeff, before we go, really quick, we're sipping on a really nice rum, and I want to just tell people about it. Can you tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is
the Rum Jam.
Rum Jam from Martinique. It's an agricole. It's just aged 3 years, but it's called their VO, very old. And it's really nice, woody. If you're a Scotch drinker, it's a really good way to sidle sideways into rum. I have a soft spot for JM because I visited the distillery, and every time I see that label, I think of the visual of the distillery. It's located in a valley in a rainforest, and there are like strings of orchids hanging from the trees as you drive down in there, and there's like lagoons and rushing rivers, and it's the most beautiful setting for a distillery ever. You know, it's kind of like right out of it's like a Harry Potter or something. You know, it's like, wow, this is amazing. You know, and so maybe that's why I like this rum so much, is I just think about that when I'm drinking it. But it does have a really nice, woody, very balanced, not too sweet kind of a...
It's an easy sipping rum on a nice ball of ice that you've given us here. So I know we've been enjoying that throughout the entire interview. So
yes, we have probably to our detriment later in the evening, but yeah.
Sounds still smart to me.
Got to live in the now, man.
Absolutely. Well, hey, Jeff, thank you so much for hosting us here today, and thanks for taking some time. I really appreciate
it. It's been a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. So friends, hey, we're going to take a little break here on the podcast. We're going to come back with our parting shot. Thanks to Jeff Berry here. Come check him out at Latitude 29. It's a great spot. Hey, we're going to be right back. Come on back. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening in to the parting shot here on NOLA Drinks. Hope you enjoyed that chat there with Jeff Beachbum Berry at Latitude 29. Great place. Thanks to Jeff, Aneen, the rest of the gang at Latitude 29. Hey, if you're here in New Orleans or if you're visiting New Orleans, make sure you go check them out. Great spot right there in the French Quarter. It is sort of history and tiki culture in a glass, and great food, as we talked about as well. So thanks again to those guys. So some stuff going on here in the news. Friends, you probably heard a little bit about this in economic news, talking about
international tariffs and trade wars going on. And some part of this maybe you hadn't heard, and we'll digress slightly. You know, the American whiskey industry has been working hard to make whiskey great again. And really, after substantial retreats that span back to the latter decades of the 20th century, really started to happen in the 60s, definitely in the 70s and 80s. This is something we've talked about on the show in times past, sort of the history of whiskey, bourbon, rye, you know, all that stuff made here in the States. And the advent of vodka has a lot to do with this, the rise of so-called clear spirits in the 70s and 80s, and there were other factors. We don't have to go too far down that road. But American whiskey was really on the ropes. And as I said, American whiskey, of course, we're talking about that broader category of, as I just mentioned, rye, Kentucky bourbon, Tennessee whiskey. Bourbon has to be made in the United States. Most of it, we'll get to that in a second, is made in Kentucky. But the broader whiskey category, as it applies to what's made in the States, and really also the broader category of spirits and distilleries here in this country, in the United States. And, you know, substantial gains were made by this industry starting in the 90s and then moving forward. And the export market is really no exception to this. Exports actually have increased from $575 million in 1997 to $1.64 billion in 2017. That's a gain of 185%. That is nothing to sneeze at, friends. And, you know, as we know, it's important to states such as Kentucky and Tennessee. Kentucky, as I was just talking about or alluding to, Kentucky boasts 95% of the world's bourbon production. Bourbon, as I said, has to be made in the United States. And just in Kentucky alone, it employs directly 17,500 workers approximately and generates approximately $8.5 billion annually. There's also the connected aspects of the supply chain, the farmers, the glass makers, the packaging people. The Distilled Spirits Council here in the States estimates that approximately 1.5 million workers are employed directly or indirectly by the spirits industry here in the United States. So now what we're talking about, of course, is this trade war stuff and these things that are going on in the news and the European Union, Mexico, Canada, Turkey, and now China are gearing up to apply retaliatory tariffs to those being imposed and threatened by the Trump administration. Now we're talking about a whole span of products here, both on both sides of the aisle, if you will. But in these countries that I just listed, and in particular of import, are EU and China, and really, you know, Mexico and Canada as well, that they're targeting American whiskey. And it's a very targeted approach. These are popular products for export in these countries. And, you know, these when these lists are picked of what is being targeted with tariffs, this is not just sort of happenstance. It's done to have an effect. It's done to target things. It's even done to sometimes, I think, target things that are symbolic, for example, in a particular economic sector. The Distilled Spirits Council that I just mentioned notes that some 46% of global U.S. spirits exports, of which 65% is U.S. whiskey, are now staring down the prospect of these tariffs. That's about $759 million worth of product, friends. And, you know, there's a bit of irony in all this as well. In the 70s and 80s, really, in many ways, the Asian and European markets help keep American whiskey alive. And during this time period, for example, some stuff was being produced that was only going to Asia. Now, the bulk of this was going to Japan, but China did play a bit of a part in this. And certainly a lot of stuff was going to Europe. So when we're over here drinking vodka and cheap, clear tequila, that was kind of a lifeline that was thrown to the industry by some of these trade partners that we have. So just as an, you know, an example that last year, China imported $12.8 million of U.S. spirits. About $8.9 million of that was whiskey. Now, that's a pretty small bit of the market, and we'll get into some more numbers here in a second. You know, so by contrast, just their neighbor, Japan, $100 million worth of whiskey was exported to that country. Okay. Kentucky exported $154 million in bourbon alone to the European Union. Now what we have these days, though, we have small, medium, and large producers that are all exporting. We now have well over 1,000 craft distillers in this country, and whiskey is made by a lot of them. There was something noted in by Reuters, of course, the media outlet, a guy named Adam Spiegel, who is the owner of Sonoma Distilling Company in California that makes a whiskey and they make a bourbon. He's afraid of being priced out of the market. About a quarter of his sales actually go to Europe. He sells his bottle for a bit over 75, makes the bourbon and a rye, excuse me. He sells that for a bit over $75 a bottle each. He's afraid this little bump, we're talking maybe 25% tariff in some of these cases, that might be enough to price him out of the market. And you can't pass that all the way down the supply chain, especially if you're a small guy. And also if you're a small guy like Mr. Spiegel is there at Sonoma Distilling Company, he doesn't have the margin to absorb that. Some of the big guys have the ability. They operate on significant profit margins, okay? And they're able to have the logistical power, the resource power, the margin power, if you will, to be able to absorb this. So for example, it's been reported that Brown-Forman, which is the brand that controls Jack Daniel's and Woodford Reserve, among others, are already rushing to ship more whiskey to warehouses in the EU to get ahead of the tariffs. Small guys can't do that, okay? They really just, they can't. They don't have the wherewithal. They don't have the distribution. They don't have the resources to do that. Now, let's contrast this a little bit too, for example, because we are talking about millions of dollars here and, oh, you know, tens of millions of dollars here in some of these instances with the export market. But let's be clear, the U.S. still dominates in consumption of American whiskey, go figure. Over 23 million cases are sold and generated, over 23 million cases were sold this past year, and that generated $3.4 billion in revenue. Okay, $3.4 billion, say, versus Kentucky bourbon at $154 million in exports of bourbon to the EU. So, you know, it's a fraction. But this is an important thing because a lot of distillers, and this is according to many sources, a lot of distillers out there, especially some of the small and medium guys, are seeing their growth, their future growth potential being based on the export market. Yes, American whiskey, bourbon, continues to remain very popular in this country, but it's a finite market here, and they see growth potential in places like China. They see growth potential in places like the EU, and these tariffs certainly, you know, can threaten this. The Distilled Spirits Council, as I've been talking about, they wrote a letter just recently to the Secretary of Commerce, whose name is Wilbur Ross, expressing their concern and requesting a meeting. And their concern is for the workers, the supply chain, the industry. We talked about some of these numbers here. Now, this is a potentially a big and damaging deal, as I said, and perhaps what we're really looking at is a big and damaging deal to the small and medium-sized guys. Yeah, the big guys can probably absorb a lot of this. And really, too, the question is this going to be a short trade spat, or is this going to be a long trade spat? This maybe lasts a few days, a few weeks, a few months, but if this goes a couple years, this is a significant threat to some of our smaller friends and our burgeoning craft distilling industry here in the United States. When it comes to making American whiskey great, the industry has done a good job. But if you're Donald Trump and his administration, keeping it from struggling greatly again, friends, well, it seems it may just not matter. That's our parting shot for you here this week on the NOLA Drink Show. Friends, thanks for listening in as always. Next week, got a great show coming up for you. We're going to be chatting with Carolyn Rosen, the new executive director of Tales of the Cocktail. We'll be talking about their signature event called Tales of the Cocktail, which takes place the third weekend of July every year here in New Orleans, but they do stuff all year round, all kinds of programming, other events. Got a new grant program to assist with issues facing the liquor industry and the hospitality bartending industry. It's going to be an interesting chat, friends. So, hey, please tune in and listen in. Here's a shot for you. Cheers, y'all.